From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
The first baby with Zika-related birth defects has been born in the New York City tri-state area.
The baby girl was born with the telltale signs of Zika, a small head and partially developed brain.
Doctors at Hackensack University Medical Center say the child was born to a mother from Honduras yesterday. The woman gave birth while vacationing, though, here in the United States.
As the virus spreads, so do fears. Last Friday, a petition signed by more than 100 doctors and health experts worldwide urged the World Health Organization to call for moving or postponing the Summer Olympics from Zika-plagued Brazil. The WHO, along with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, say there is so far no public health justification for such drastic action. So, naturally, into the vacuum of official uncertainty rushes pseudoscience and paranoia. Mark Dredzi is an assistant professor of computer science at Johns Hopkins University and the lead author of a new study about Zika virus-related conspiracy theories. He and his team had spent a lot of time looking at social media to understand why people refuse vaccines. And earlier this year, they noticed that Zika chatter had started to show up in anti-vaccine threads. After separating out those sharing reasonable information about Zika from those sharing misinformation, the researchers built a computational algorithm that could learn to tell the difference.
When we ran that over about 140,000 messages, there were really two dominant theories that were being spread. One was that Zika was not at all the cause of the birth defects that we were seeing. Rather, they were the side effects from a vaccination campaign in Brazil, which is obviously untrue. The other theory that we saw was that Zika was actually the result of genetically modified mosquitoes, some part of a mosquito eradication campaign that had gone awry. There is an active anti-GMO population. There's an active vaccine refusal population. And that's what makes this so much more concerning. If it was just a conspiracy theory that no one really believed and couldn't gain traction, we wouldn't worry about it. But because it fits an existing narrative where you already have a group that believes it, it gives it the air of credibility. And it's more likely to spread in the population to people who don't believe these things in the first place, but are genuinely concerned and go online to find information about Zika.
There's certainly no shortage of subject matter that people want to impose their own explanations for. Some of this stuff is so insane. Airplane contrails?
There are really crazy theories out there, whether it's airplane contrails, the idea that somehow the government is trying to manipulate the population through covert chemical spraying, or Americans are naturally immune to Zika, or that Bill Gates is behind some kind of bioweapon that led to this. This is a virus that, while it's existed for a very long time and we've known about it for a long time, the side effects we're seeing now are really new. And when it first happened, there was legitimately a lack of information in the scientific community about exactly what was going on. When people lack credible information, they go out to find whatever information is there. And we need to make sure that we combat that information so that we can spread proper medical information to people who really are trying to just figure out what's going on.
So as we've established, there is a certain population that believes that there is a conspiracy between government and pharma to make vaccines irrespective of their negative effects. And the Zika outbreak is just one more smoking gun. As you say, they're not going to be disabused of their paranoia. The question is, what can be done to keep their ravings from infecting others?
Well, I think the only counter to misinformation is accurate information. And that's why public health organizations like the CDC spend so much time trying to inform the public, whether it's on their website or through social media campaigns. I think in this context, the news media does have an important role to play. The normal inclination is that every subject has two sides. But in the context of medicine, there is often an objective truth. And so when it comes to reporting on diseases like Zika or Ebola or childhood vaccinations, if we do include information that the medical establishment knows is not true, these pseudoscientific theories, then we should pay attention to how much time we give it and how it's being framed. If we have an anecdote about a child that was harmed from a measles vaccine, and then we follow it with statistics about the dangers of measles, we should make sure that the time allocated to both really conveys that the side effects from measles vaccines is exceedingly rare, whereas the dangers of measles are really quite real. Oftentimes, we get bogged down in anecdotes and statistics, and people lose the big picture. We need to come back to this clear message that, in this case, Zika is dangerous, and you should take preventative steps to prevent you or your family from contracting it.
All right, I understand what you say, but as you know, there is research, I think it was done by the CDC itself, that says the harder public health officials work to debunk false claims, the more those false claims are cemented in the minds of the public, that the education campaigns actually can be counterproductive. If that's true, what is a public health ecosystem to do?
That is certainly a problem. I think, though, there's a larger population of people who really are undecided, people who don't know, are really going out there to seek what is the best thing to do. So let's take childhood vaccinations. There are a lot of people who have kids, and they go to the doctor, and it's time to give their child the vaccine, and they generally don't have preconceived notions. So they go online, or they talk to their friends, and they start looking for information. It's those people that I think we have a good job of convincing. We want to make sure that they don't form the impression that, well, some people say vaccines are dangerous, some people say they're safe, therefore, I don't know what to do, I'm going to err on the side of safety. We want to make sure they understand that overwhelmingly the medical establishment says vaccines are completely safe, and that they shouldn't be misled by these pseudoscientific theories. We should focus on trying to inform that population. In the case of Zika, that population is really large because people don't know what Zika is and they're really exposed to it for the first time. So I think in that context, proper messaging by the medical establishment and public health officials can have a really big impact.
Mark, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Bob.
Mark Dredze is an assistant researcher of computer science at Johns Hopkins University and lead author of the study, Zika Vaccine Misconceptions, a Social Media Analysis. Disease and pestilence are by no means the only breeding grounds for conspiracy theory. For the past 15 years since 9/11, skeptics ranging from the unconvinced to the unhinged have argued that the U.S. government is hiding important details of the murderous plot. Most of the putative evidence, from melted steel beams attributed to U.S. military demolition to the supposed zero Jewish victims, is hogwash. On the other hand, the government absolutely is keeping something from us, namely 3% of the 838-page congressional report on the 9/11 terror conspiracy, classified by the Bush and Obama administrations on national security grounds. Some who have seen the 28 pages say they are a revelation. Here's Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey.
He's in a room where it's soundproof and you're escorted in there and you're escorted out and there are no notes. As I read it, I had to stop every couple pages and just sort of absorb and try to rearrange my understanding of history for the past 13 years and the years leading up to that. It challenges you to rethink everything.
Apparently by uncovering a Saudi role in 9/11. Not only the 15 of 19 al-Qaeda hijackers, but a support network of others. If true, the Saudi connection could undermine a strategic U.S. alliance of decades standing. Philip Sheenan is the author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. He says that there is already little doubt about at least a low-level official Saudi involvement in the terror plot.
A former diplomat by the name of Fahad al-Thumairi, a fully accredited diplomat in the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles, who had been sent to Los Angeles by the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs. Thumairi appears to have been in touch with other members of the Saudi support network in Southern California that went out of its way to support the two hijackers.
It's significant that this was the Ministry for Islamic Affairs, because although the Saudis were important to the United States strategically in the Cold War, and important strategically as one of the guarantors of stability with respect to Israel, it's also an exporter of its Wahhabi strain of Islam that is extremely fundamentalist, extremely radical, fully embraced by Al-Qaeda. Even if the king and his ministers were not somehow in the loop, is it among the possibilities that there were elements within the security services and the Ministry of Islamic Affairs that were operating under a very different agenda?
Absolutely. The congressional investigators who went at this in 2001 and 2002 came away convinced that there was some sort of low-level tie to the Saudi government.
What was the official reason for keeping them classified?
President Bush at the time said that they would damage the war on terror if they were made public, and he cited national security grounds. But as best any of us really understands it, these pages have been kept secret all these years because somehow they might damage our strategic and financial relationship with Saudi Arabia.
There's a character at the center of this, a historian named Philip Zelikow. Tell me about him.
Philip Zelikow was a very well-regarded historian who was named as the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He really ran the investigation on a day-to-day basis. But there was a lot of concern from the very beginning that he faced major conflicts of interest, if only because he was very friendly with people like Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor and who was in many ways a subject, if not a target, of the 9/11 Commission investigation. Some of the staff investigators on the commission who focused specifically on the Saudi material felt that Zelikow was trying to limit their investigation. And in fact, he fired one of the staff members who managed to obtain a copy of the 28 pages outside of official channels. And after the 9/11 Commission went out of business, Zelikow went to work as a senior advisor to Condoleezza Rice at the State Department.
Now, at some point, this conversation begins to sound like an Oliver Stone movie, where murky facts and arbitrary investigative dead ends suggest a sinister backstory that we as citizens simply are not presented. Has the very withholding of this information simply just inflated our sense of paranoia?
Well, I think this is so typical of government in action that by keeping these pages secret for all these years, so much attention has been focused on what may be in there. People may be very disappointed to discover what's in there, if only because so much has been out there on the public record for so long. And the evidence really isn't that murky in many ways about what happened in San Diego. There was a support network of Arab men, many of them Saudis, who stepped forward from out of the shadows to help the two hijackers. Some of those men do indeed have ties to the Saudi government.
So with that as prologue, now it seems that these 28 pages may finally become public. What's happened?
President Obama has been tougher on the Saudis than his predecessors. That seemed to spark interest in trying to get the Obama administration to declassify them. But one of the reasons we're hearing so much about the 28 pages now is because there is legislation pending before Congress that would allow American citizens to sue foreign governments that are tied to terrorism. And this legislation is particularly targeted at Saudi Arabia.
The government of Saudi Arabia is kind of on its heels right now. The low price of oil has devastated its economy, and its sphere of influence in the Middle East is under constant threat by Iran. If these pages are released and they do document ties of low-level Saudi officials with the 9/11 conspirators, is it going to totally upset the apple cart of a 60-year strategic alliance?
I tend to doubt that. To its credit, the Saudi government, since 2002, has been asking for the 28 pages to be released to the public. It says it has nothing to hide. And I think perhaps if the United States government had given in to the Saudis all those years ago and released the pages, this might have all blown over years and years ago.
All right, so what's going to happen?
You get some sense that there is an effort by the Obama administration to stall on this. They originally suggested they would have a decision within weeks about whether or not to declassify the 28 pages this spring. Now that's been pushed off till June. And we've already heard in recent weeks from the CIA director, John Brennan, saying he does not want them to be released because he says they will do damage to our relationship with Saudi Arabia and they will smear innocent people. I think if we end this with a decision by the Obama administration to keep them secret, I won't be terribly surprised.
In the end, the fact remains that we were victims of a historic horror that required someone to get to the bottom of. Isn't this a case for just telling that story in as much context as possible and letting the chips fall where they may?
Absolutely. And as somebody who's been dealing for many years with the families of 9/11 victims, you know, I believe they're entitled to every bit of information our government has about this turning point in American history. And I think for them to be tormented daily by the thought that there are secrets still being withheld from them is a terrible, terrible thing.
Well, Phil, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bob.
Philip Sheenan is the author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Coming up, the life and death of a crusading journalist. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. When it emerged in the early 80s, AIDS was creeping selective death. On a December day 25 years ago, it entered the life of New York Times reporter Jeffrey Schmaltz. The disease set him on a new course, one that eventually changed the way the paper of record and many others around the country wrote about AIDS and about gay life. Jeff Schmaltz was a prodigy at the Times. He dropped out of college to become a copy editor. Rising up the ladder, he was a deputy national editor by the time he was 37. Schmaltz is the subject of an hour-long documentary called Dying Words, produced by Kerry Donahue and Sam Friedman. In honor of Pride Month, we offer a rebroadcast of our excerpted version. It begins with Sam Friedman, who'd just been hired at the Times when he met Jeff Schmaltz. Jeff became Sam's mentor and his friend, Sam Friedman.
From the time I was a teenager, my dream was to someday be a reporter on the New York Times. And on the day I started that job in 1981, I met my new boss. I was 26, and he was just 2 years older than me. He was a rigorous and inspiring editor who made me a better writer. And when my work met his lofty standards, he promoted it, sometimes getting me on the front page. There was another thing about Jeff. He was the first person in my life to tell me he was gay, confidently. Unashamedly. But in the office, to his bosses, Jeff was tightly in the closet. Until this one day, just before Christmas in 1990. An unexpectedly quiet day on the national desk, Jeff was working editing copy.
Suddenly, I couldn't see the screen well, and I stood up. I thought, if I can just get some air, I'll be all right. I collapsed to the floor and went into a full-blown seizure, grand mal seizure, in the middle of the newsroom.
Jeff was soon diagnosed with AIDS, making him just one of nearly 8,000 people to be stricken by the incurable disease that year in New York City alone. Months later, Jeff was able to return to work, and when he did, he had a mission.
I feel an obligation to those with AIDS to write about it, and an obligation to the newspaper to write what just about no other reporter in America can cover in quite the same way. And I feel an obligation to myself, this is the place reporting where I'm at home. This is the place where I must come to terms with AIDS.
Soma Golden Bear was national editor of the Times then.
A lot of people were still closed off to AIDS. It's not in my life. Jeff took that in a poignant way. It wasn't just about one guy when you read it. It was everybody's brother, parents' kid, and I think that's been a huge part of what has transformed this country.
But newspaper articles don't last, especially articles that are now 25 years old. And I despaired that his work had been forgotten. My quest to bring it back to life led me here to a converted barn in upstate New York.
I was up here, wow.
Jeff Schmaltz's sister Wendy lives in a small house, a couple of hours north of New York City. She keeps Jeff's papers and notes in boxes, including cassette tapes of the dozens of interviews he did for his AIDS stories. Each one has a label and a scribbled name.
Yeah, Magic Johnson.
Clinton.
Oh, Harold Brodkey, wow.
Wendy works today as a literary agent.
Barney Frank.
Like Jeff, her professional life led her a long way from where they both began, in a small Pennsylvania town.
We grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia called Willow Grove.
Their father was out of the picture, an alcoholic who died when Jeff was a teenager. Their mother worked as a manager at the local Sears.
It was hard in the early 60s to have two children and work full time, and I think she had to be very strict, and she always instilled in us a drive for perfection.
Jeff got into Columbia University with a special scholarship for fatherless boys. And since he'd worked on his high school newspaper, he applied for a copyboy's job on the New York Times. A copyboy's job in those days was to deliver stories from reporter to editor, from editor to printing press.
And he knew what he was carrying, and he knew what he was doing, he knew what you were doing.
Alan Siegel was the news editor of the Times. He hired Jeff.
If an editor overlooked something, he'd tactfully bring the piece of paper back and say, "Didn't you mean to do something here?" And his suggestions were always on point.
For Jeff, the Times was a perfect fit. He dropped out of school at age 20 after being hired as a copy editor on the New York Times.
I don't know that I would want to be a newspaper man for anybody else. I'm a Times man.
He talked about that in a 1993 interview.
There's an anecdote, you know, some mayor of New York, I don't know if it was Jimmy Walker or whatever, and he asked if there were any reporters out there waiting to see him, and the aide said that there are four reporters and a gentleman from the Times.
Throughout the 70s and much of the 80s, as long as a gay reporter at the Times stayed secretive, the paper was willing to operate on a basis of don't ask, don't tell.
It was more a matter of omission rather than commission.
Rich Meislin, former editor and reporter at the New York Times.
Things that you didn't say, things that you didn't talk about, you know, the pronoun of who you saw last weekend, laughing at jokes where gay people were the butt of the joke. You'd laugh along because you had a cover to protect.
Even as gays and lesbians were struggling within the Times, reports began to emerge about a mysterious new illness striking gay men.
This is NBC Nightly News.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
The New York Times first reported on the disease in July 1981. It was a medical story under the headline, "Rare Cancer Seen in 41 Homosexuals." But the story was buried on page 20, just a single column stuck to the left of a big ad for holiday fireworks.
If it had been the Boy Scouts or PTA moms, it would have been on the front page.
Eric Marcus is a journalist and the author of Making Gay History. He was a network TV producer in the late 80s.
What I found when I worked in journalism during those years was a profession that was completely unprepared to cover gay people in general, let alone an epidemic.
When Eric worked at ABC's Good Morning America, he had to convince his colleagues to let him do a story about AIDS as part of a series on being single in America. But the show's film library only had a handful of stock images.
They showed gay men stripped to the waist, sweaty and gyrating in a disco, or they showed two guys holding hands, shot from behind, walking down Castro Street. But I wanted to show gay people beyond discos. And I got the Front Runners, which was an organization of gay runners here in New York, to allow me to come and shoot background footage. And they were thrilled because gay people were hungry for true portrayals in the media. We shot the footage, and the executive producer said no, that the only way that we could portray gay people in this segment was with footage of gay people at discos.
By 1983, more than 500 people in the United States had died from AIDS, and 1,000 others had been diagnosed. Jeff saw that the paper was missing a very big story. Mike Norman was a Metro reporter then, one of the strongest and straightest reporters on Jeff's desk. He was a former Marine who'd served in Vietnam and was now married and raising kids in the suburbs. Jeff convinced his boss, Peter Malonis, to assign Mike to do a big feature story on AIDS and gay life in the city.
And when Peter gave it to me, he said, "Just remember, we want you to write about gays as if you're writing about the daughters of the American Revolution. We don't want anything melodramatic, And above all, we don't want sex. I said, okay, I can do that. So I go walking out of Malonis's office, and I didn't get 10 or 12 feet before there's Schmaltz right in my face. And he says, you know I'm gay, don't you? I mean, I didn't know for sure, but I just said, of course, Jeffrey. He said, you're going to need help with this. And I remember two places that he took me to. They were nightclubs, and they were subterranean, both of them. And in one, you had to take off your shirt when you walked in the door. I said, okay, fine, I'll take off my shirt. So Jeff is not only talking to people he knew in these clubs, but he's also sort of half keeping an eye on me. And I got propositioned a bunch of times, you know. If it got to be too much, Jeff would always just kind of slip in and say, hi, I'm his editor. He's really got to work.
In 1990, Jeff was 37 years old and deputy national editor, and the newsroom had changed. There was an openness that came from a new executive editor, Max Frankel, and from the incoming publisher, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. Rich Meislin remembers.
Arthur was taking people out for lunch and asking them what it was like to be gay at the New York Times. And you, like, dropped your fork because the message it was sending was, I know and it's okay.
Gay and lesbian staffers started to test that new tolerance, even posting signs around the newsroom to gather a group for the annual Gay Pride March.
And the signs said, we're having a party, we'd love to invite you, but we don't know who you are.
The times had changed, but Jeff wasn't taking any chances. Maybe he could have come out if he'd been content to stay a regular reporter, but it was something else entirely to be an openly gay man on the masthead, and the masthead was where Jeff wanted to be. So he stayed in the closet to his bosses, at least until the December afternoon in late 1990, when he collapsed at his desk.
Doctors and medical technicians arriving, and I just remember this big fuss. And I remember kept telling people, I'm okay, I'm okay. And they kept saying, you're not okay.
Jeff's sister, Wendy, was at her office Christmas party.
When the phone rang, and it was someone at the Times who said that he had had a seizure in the newsroom and was rushed to St. Clair's Hospital. And Rich Meislin had gone with him.
It was horrible. Nobody understood why it was Jeff collapsed, including Jeff, although I suspect that he suspected.
I don't know, maybe an hour and a half later, Jeff comes out. I'm fine. Let's just go to Joe Allen's and have some dinner.
Jeff hadn't been tested for HIV before his collapse, but more seizures led to more tests. He went back to his doctor weeks later for the results.
He said, I must tell you that you officially have AIDS, and furthermore, your T-cell count is 2. Most normal people would have 1,000 T-cells. My life expectancy at that point was really a matter of weeks. And I remember getting in the cab, leaving my doctor. You know, we're talking about a 5-minute cab ride. And I thought, God, I hope I live just these 5 minutes. That was how much I thought I was going to die immediately.
He called me the day he got the diagnosis.
Jeff's sister, Wendy.
He was completely unsentimental and said, this is what I want for my funeral. This is what, don't tell mom because she shouldn't know yet. We have to figure out what we're going to do. Very businesslike. And again, over dinner, over martinis, it was just, it was like he was going away for vacation and I had to feed his fish. I mean, he was that matter of fact about it.
Jeff was equally matter of fact when he went to tell executive editor Max Frankel about his diagnosis.
I said, Max, I have the results of the tests, and it's very bad news. It's about as bad as it could be, actually. I have full-blown AIDS. And he looked stunned. And he said, does this surprise you? And I said, well, when you're a gay man, it's always in the back of your mind that you can have AIDS.
He left that day with every reassurance that if he were able to return, he'd still have a job at the paper. By that year, 1990, more than 60,000 people had already died of AIDS in the United States. For the next few months, Jeff was in and out of the hospital for pneumonia, for blood clots. He underwent brain surgery.
I think emotionally, I just collapsed. I just became so despondent. I just thought, this is it. I'll never recover from this.
But then, to everyone's astonishment, Jeff did recover. He went on AZT, the primary drug treatment at the time. He felt better, and he thought about taking whatever time he had left to travel. But then he realized,
it is not my way. And my way for 20 years has been the New York Times. The New York Times defines who I am in a lot of ways. And I wanted to work this out in the pages of the New York Times.
Even though the Times had become a much more tolerant place for its gay employees, the paper's coverage of the AIDS epidemic was widely criticized by gay activists. The group ACT UP even held a protest march outside the publisher's apartment. In their eyes, by not giving more prominent attention to the disease, the Times was contributing to the death of thousands of people.
In retrospect, I feel terrible that I wasn't more open and that I didn't say, wait a minute, this is outrageous. We're missing this epidemic. And I didn't. I was afraid. I was a coward, really. And one of the things that happened when I got AIDS was that I made the decision that I was not going to be timid about either having AIDS or being gay, and that I was going to speak out, and that I was going to use my position to help both those causes.
It was unheard of for a reporter at the Times to deliberately abandon his or her objectivity, especially on a topic where you had such a personal stake. But when he went back to work, Jeff wrote a series of profiles of people suffering from AIDS. All of them, like him, were still working in spite of the disease. A San Francisco AIDS doctor, a gay Bill Clinton campaign staffer, a mother infected by a blood transfusion, and Mary Fisher, a Republican insider, tapped to speak at the 1992 Republican convention.
I mean, I really confronted her and said, you know, how can you speak at this Republican convention when these Republicans have done nothing for AIDS? Enter now Mary Fisher, very rich, very Republican, and very much infected with the virus that causes AIDS. With her shoulder-length blonde hair styled just so, Ms. Fisher is right out of Republican central casting. The Muffy Buffy Jody look writ expensive. And why not? Her Republican credentials are impeccable.
You know, I didn't like that description of me, but other than that, I thought that the article was really right on, and I thought he was very honest.
Ms. Fisher, who so far has not had any AIDS-related illnesses, is caught between the worlds of Republican politics and AIDS activism, both of them at times uneasy about her.
He soon came to realize that he had a lot in common with Mary Fisher. They both had to stop during the interview to take their doses of AZT, and they'd both chosen to be very public about their illness.
A few minutes later at the door, she rushed up. "I want a big hug," she said. With that, she threw open her arms, squeezing tight, and whispered, "Stay well."
Jeff wrote about those small moments of connection. And when he did, he showed readers the experience of living with AIDS in precise and indelible ways. His fierce specificity was paradoxically the thing that made his articles so broadly relevant, so universal.
The mission on the one hand is to just in general show the public that even an editor at the New York Times can get AIDS, that people in general with AIDS are not the scum of the earth. And also, I want people with AIDS to see me. I want them to hear the message that you're not dead immediately because you have AIDS. You're not dead till you're dead.
Coming up, Schmaltz transforms, and in so doing, transforms the public perception of gay men and women and the disease that was killing them. This is On the Media.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it, and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a very, it's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. We pick up the story of Jeff Schmaltz during the 1992 presidential race when he scored an interview with then-Governor Bill Clinton. Schmaltz asked him why he thought gay issues had emerged in the campaign. Clinton replied that AIDS had a lot to do with it. Sam Friedman.
Jeff's interview with Bill Clinton became part of a larger story about the emergence of a gay and lesbian constituency in American politics. It was like the entire community starting to come out of the closet.
Today's New York Times features an in-depth interview with Magic Johnson, but there is more to that story. The man who wrote it, assistant national editor Jeffrey Schmaltz, has AIDS.
Jeff went on the Charlie Rose Show to talk about his profile of basketball star Magic Johnson. Johnson was HIV positive, and he'd been forced to retire from the NBA. Other players said they felt it was too dangerous to play with him on the court.
Take us there to the time you two are talking.
He asked me a lot about myself, and then it got a little wrenching when we started sort of pressing back and forth, as happens in these AIDS.
What's wrenching?
Well, I asked him, had he not betrayed people with AIDS by pulling out of the league? And I think he was very stricken by that question coming from me. I don't think it would have been the same if it had come from you.
Right.
But then he came back with a very thoughtful answer, and he started talking on and on about his life and how he was really two people. He was Magic and he was Irvin, and how AIDS or HIV had changed his life. And
so that there was no more Magic.
Jeff's life was going through its own transformation. He was in a steady relationship, his first since college, and with a man he'd met at an AIDS support group. He bought an apartment near Lincoln Center, moving out of the place he'd occupied since college. Even his writing had changed. It became looser, more conversational, less Timesian. Old friends like columnist and novelist Anna Quinlan noticed something bigger going on.
It wasn't that Jeff's style changed. It was that Jeff's character changed. He was incredibly skilled, but he could be really arrogant and judgmental when I first met him. There was a sense that he was judging you harshly because you'd messed up, because he was more capable than you were, which was almost always true, but is not attractive. And I hate to say it because the trope of the person and noble humanized by terrible illness is such a cliche, but in his case, it was completely true.
I mean, he whistled. You'd always know he's coming around the corner because you heard the sound of his whistle.
Adam Moss is now the editor of New York Magazine. Back then, he sat next to Jeff at the Times.
He was one of the happier-seeming people. I didn't know the old Jeff. I didn't know the button-down Jeff. I just knew this new Jeff who felt, I think, so relieved not to be carrying secrets, not to be having to perform the function of a Times man.
Jeff's articles in the Times began to gather growing attention. The New Yorker and New York Magazine ran features on him. ABC News profiled him. The star photographer Annie Leibovitz did a spread of Jeff at work for Vanity Fair. Then, in late 1992, Jeff tackled his most personal story yet, his own. When he did, the words poured out of him.
I took it over to Joe Lelyveld, who's the managing editor, and I said, I've written this piece. He came over a little while later and said, we'll print it. And that was it, and we put it in the newspaper.
That piece was titled A Reporter's Testimony, Covering AIDS and Living It. Jeff wrote about waking up with nightmares where he was in a coffin. He wrote about his mother's death after she learned he had AIDS. He wrote about his sense of being completely alone.
I make sure everyone with AIDS whom I interview knows that I have it too. To be sure that is an interview ploy. I'm hoping the camaraderie will open them up. But there is more to it than that. I want them to take a good look at me, to see that someone with full-blown AIDS can carry on for a while. Much of the time it works. Their faces light up. There is hope. But sometimes it fails, and I am the one changed by our chat, overcome by guilt that I have lived these 2 years, when so many of my friends and hospital roommates and people I've interviewed have died. At times I think my fellow AIDS sufferers are laughing at me, looking up from their beds with eyes that say, you'll be here soon enough.
After the piece ran, Jeff got hundreds of letters from readers. They covered the whole range of attitudes at the time about gay men and about AIDS.
Some of them were incredibly nasty. I think all you bastards with AIDS ought to just die. You ought to be in a home, the least expensive ones possible, until you die. Pretty much what one of them said recently. Most of the letters are favorable and very moving. You know, a wonderful letter from a woman in Florida. My son died of AIDS. His name was also Jeffrey. And she detailed his agonizing death. She was running it to me, like so many of them write, to use me really as the sounding board for just venting all of their own emotions and their own horrors with this disease. And then she ended the letter by saying, consider this letter a mother's hug. And I cried, really, when I read that letter. I carry it around with me and read it from time to time.
In February of 1993, he addressed students at a private school in Manhattan.
Do you ever feel cheated?
When you think that you're going to die, as I did,
And then you rebound and you live, and not only live, but thrive. You don't feel cheated, you feel blessed. I stand before you as someone who was given time, a year now, that I never thought I would have. And time that I've been able to put to really good use. I'm proud of that.
Jeff made sure the students knew there was no escape from the reality of his situation.
It's like knowing that you're going to be killed by a speeding car, but you don't know what moment, you don't know what day. It could happen this afternoon, it could happen 2 years from now. And so you always live with this sense of, my God, this car is running to me. When is it going to hit me?
By now, Jeff knows that no last-minute miracle will save him. Worse still, he senses that national interest in AIDS is waning.
We were talking, and he uttered the phrase, whatever happened to AIDS? And I said to him, that's a magazine article.
Adam Moss was then the editor of the New York Times Magazine. He encouraged Jeff to write a major article about the state of AIDS.
The thesis of the story is very simple. A lot of the political wars had been won. It was no longer a function of getting funding for AIDS. AIDS had come up against a wall, and that wall was the wall of science. Is that with all of the money and with all of the sort of changed policies, they were still stuck at this moment when they could not solve the disease.
The heart of the piece is Jeff's despair that the suffering of AIDS victims is still being pushed to the margins.
I usually say that my epitaph is not a phrase, but the body of my work. But actually, there is, in fact, a phrase that I once shouted at my funeral and written on the memorial cards, a phrase that captures the mix of cynicism and despair that I feel right now and that I will almost certainly take to my grave. Whatever happened to AIDS?
The piece alternates between Jeff's personal experiences living with AIDS, taking his boyfriend to the emergency room on a Sunday morning, and his interviews with key AIDS doctors, activists, and public health officials. He fleshed out the first-person sections early on, but by late summer, Jeff was getting sicker and weaker.
One was torn as his editor and his friend between wanting to push him, yet not to push him because there were clearly more important things happening to him, which is that he was sort of grappling with his end.
Jeff's brain infection returned. He went to lunch one day with a longtime friend and colleague on the Times, David Dunlap.
And as we walked back toward the Times headquarters, Jeff had his arm through mine, partly out of fondness, perhaps out of just physical support to help keep him steady. And it was clear that he wanted to stay arms locked until we had to negotiate the revolving door. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm walking arm in arm with another man toward the New York Times building and having that old fear, like, what if they see me? Who is they?
By the fall, Jeff was at home. He could no longer speak. But the urge to write never left him. Jeff's brother-in-law, Michael Wilde, recalls one particular day when Jeff gestured that he wanted a pen and paper.
And, you know, I remember the nurse saying, don't even bother with that. And I remember Wendy saying, he's a writer. He needs to have this. It would take him a long time, but he would write stuff out. And one of the last things he wrote out was, this is odious, dying is monstrous.
David Dunlap lived a few blocks away. Early one morning, he got a call. Come quick.
There was a nurse there, and Wendy was there. We're in the bedroom. We gather around Jeff. I recall having my left arm under Jeff's shoulder and head so that he was cradled in the crook of my left elbow. And basically it was a matter, as you do with the dying, of saying, as we did, it's all right. You've done your job. You've got love is everywhere around you. And that was the end. I mean, then all of the things began to kick in that you do, the calls and the coroner and the removal of the body and all of that.
Jeff Schmaltz died on November 6, 1993. He was 39. Jeff's obituary ran in the New York Times and other major newspapers around the country. But even in death, he had his critics. U.S. News and World Report published a column deriding Jeff's first-person journalism. Jeff's sister, Wendy.
In Jeff's will, it says, "Under no circumstances am I to be buried in the family plot in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania." He didn't want to go home again.
Jeff's friends and family gathered early one morning a week later on one of the piers along the Hudson River, a place that had famously been a gay cruising spot. Jeff's brother-in-law, Michael Wilde, reading from his diary.
"Scattering the ashes, 6:30 a.m. at the Christopher Street Pier on West Street, what Jeff jokingly referred to as the scene of the crime. The somber moment approaches, the tin is opened, and we discover the remains of Jeff in a plastic bag. Ben opens this with a Swiss Army knife, and Rich peers into the can and describes the contents as gravelly. A sober silence is observed, and Jeff is scattered to the wind. This wasn't Jeff the hero, it was just Jeff, and we were his family."
2 weeks later, the Times ran Jeff's final story with the title, "Whatever Happened to AIDS?"
On Sunday, the cover story in the New York Times Sunday magazine was written by a journalist named Jeffrey Schmaltz, who lived and just a couple of weeks ago died with AIDS.
President Clinton gave his World AIDS Day address a few days later on December 1st.
He was a remarkable man who interviewed me in a very piercing way last year when I was running for president. He challenged us all with these words in the article, "I am dying. Why doesn't someone help us?" I have to say to you that I think that is a good question and a good challenge.
A week later, a public memorial took place at the Dalton School in Manhattan.
"Good evening. Thank you for joining us here tonight."
The high school auditorium was packed with mourners, and David Dunlap gave one of the final tributes. He said the way Jeff described gay life jumped out at the reader from the long gray columns of the Times.
"Jeff's choice of words let readers know the writer knew his subject, that he moved with familiarity through the territory he was describing, that he recognized its pace and its quirks. No question about it, Jeff was pushing hard, very hard, and not everyone was pleased. But something important began to happen. Straight readers were making our acquaintance more intimately than ever before. And gay readers who had known only an anguished loyalty to an ignorant and indifferent Times began to feel as if their stories might finally find a hope in our pages. Something else happened. Those of us at the Times who saw ourselves in the vanguard during the 1980s learned quickly, thanks to Jeff, what it meant to come all the way out of the closet, to make demands and take risks.
Today, there are gay TV stars, gay athletes, gay politicians, and marriage equality is the law of the land. Hardly anyone seems to realize how big a part Jeff's AIDS coverage and his role as the out gay star of the New York Times played in all this positive social change. Eric Marcus, the author of Making Gay History.
So much has changed in the last 20 years, 25 years, that it makes it hard to understand why he mattered and why he made such a difference. Today, I don't have to follow the gay press to understand where we are in the gay rights movement. I read the New York Times.
Jeff wrote about 36 stories on AIDS in the year and a half before he died. Nearly all of the people he profiled with AIDS died not long after he did. And they were just some of the more than 600,000 people who've died in the United States since the epidemic began. AIDS caused Jeff Schmaltz to collapse on that December afternoon 25 years ago. And facing death, Jeff asked himself some hard questions.
Here's your life. This is it. If you died tomorrow, would you be happy? Would you feel you had achieved what you wanted to achieve? Is this how you want to go out of this world, the way you are right now? And the answer came back, no, it isn't how I want to go out. Okay, let's change it, and let's change it now. We don't have a lot of time here. And I did. I just changed it really very quickly. I've constructed this life that I have right now. I'm extremely happy in a certain way. I know that sounds ridiculous. Here I am dying. Yet my life, in a lot of ways, has never been happier, has never been more directed
I mean, I feel more content. I feel that this is where I should have been all along, and I'm sorry that it took a fatal disease to do it, but better late than never.
This was a shorter version of Dying Words, the AIDS reporting of Jeffrey Schmaltz, which was produced by Carrie Donahue and Sam Friedman and edited and mixed by Ben Shapiro. To hear the full version and check out the companion book, go to dyingwordsproject.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.